You will remember from that ordeal of the two prophets, who expose the Antichrist, showing that he is not the Messiah but is a deceiver and a robber. The Antichrist killed them. He made war with them, defeated them, and killed them. And we continue. And their dead body shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. So their dead body was thrown into the street of the great city, which is called allegorically, that is, spiritually Sodom and Egypt, in that city in which their Lord too was crucified. By the term dead body, he shows the fury and hatred of the beast, that is, of the Antichrist, against the two prophets. And the exposure of their bodies in the central square of the city shows the utmost humiliation. And indeed, it will last 3.5 days. The outcome of this treatment that the Antichrist will inflict on the two prophets, to kill them and to cast out their bodies, their corpses, as it puts it there, into the square of Jerusalem. As we will see further on, of the city, for 3.5 days, will be manifold. First, the lax Christians, those who are gripped by cowardice, and cowardice is the most terrible sin, my beloved. I tell you this from the very outset. It will be a long while before we reach this point, for it is in the last chapter of the Apocalypse, and we will be slow to get there. I am in no hurry. Let us live the struggle. Here we will go slowly, step by step, through the books of the Apocalypse, interpreting it. First, we will see that, the cowardly, their portion shall be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. He sets down the sorcerers there too, and he sets down the immoral. But the cowardly he places first, to show that cowardice is a terrible sin. When I am intimidated and change my stance toward Christ, please, let us watch out for cowardice. Let us practice ascesis, ascetic discipline upon ourselves, so that when some terror ever comes that presses me to cast off my faith, I will not do it. You'll ask me, what are these exercises I can do to fight against cowardice? I tell you, there are many. There are so many. Suppose they lock us in, by mistake, let's say, and they shut us inside. Everyone has left except us, and it is dark. And let's say there was a chair, and we sit down in it and fall asleep. And when we wake up, we see that everyone has gone, and the church is locked, and it is cold. What will we do? We'd burst into tears, believe me. Some people would burst into tears. Someone would say, we're shut in for good, and 1,000 other things like this, to which we must constantly accustom ourselves. We must constantly put ourselves to the test, on our own, so that we can overcome anything that turns against us, and not fall into cowardice and lose everything. So the cowardly Christians, the lukewarm Christians, these are the ones who will be terrified when they see the two prophets killed, and their corpses thrown out in the street, and they will go so far as to deny their faith. Do you know what they will say? They will say, the game is over, it is finished. Christ's own disciples nearly said the very same thing. Remember, why did Thomas leave? Thomas left because he had lost heart, and so had the other disciples. The Lord said it, it is written, when they were all swearing, not only the apostle Peter, Lord, I am with you, even to death and to prison, even to death and to prison. It is written, this very night, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. And to the apostle Peter, who kept insisting, he said, well then, before the cock crows twice, you, Peter, will have denied me 3 times. This is what happened to the disciples, and this is what will happen then to very many Christians. They will see the two prophets killed, and they will say, well, that is the end of it now. Give up. They did nothing. They admired them. They praised them. They said, we will go along with them. But now that they have become an object of the Antichrist's vengeance, they threw it all away. It is terrible. Take heed of it, I beg you. Still more, indeed, when they reach that point, they will deny their faith, and they will be many. You will see why they are many. We will look at it a little further down. It is what the Lord said. Luke 18:8, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? When I come again to the earth, will I find faith? Still others among the lax Christians will be scandalized. Seeing the abandonment of the two prophets by God, just as many were scandalized when they saw the Messiah, who said that he was the Messiah, upon the cross, they did not remember the saint, Isaiah the prophet, and the other prophets. For there the prophet Isaiah speaks of the sufferings of the Messiah, essentially. Do you know what this is? What it is that will scandalize? That already scandalizes, my beloved. It is the scandal of history and the scandal of the cross, the cruciform message of the gospel. That is what it is, and even now this scandalizes. We have two scandals, three scandals. The first is the scandal of the cross, the second, the scandal of history, and the third, the scandal of monasticism. Three scandals. The scandal of the cross is that the Messiah went up onto the cross, and God abandoned him. Look, the crucifier said. The ones who instigated it, the rulers, look, he saved others, but himself he cannot save. He said he was the Son of God, so let him come down from the cross, that we may see and believe. They were satisfied that Jesus was not the Messiah. The wretched men had crucified their own Messiah. And so they will look upon the prophets then, and ask why God abandoned them. People will look upon the righteous, upon the saints throughout history, and ask why God abandoned them. The scandal of the cross, the message of the gospel, my dear friends, is a message of the cross. It is cruciform. It is not a message of comfort. It is martyrdom. And consequently, who are those who will hold up under this scandal of the cross? The scandal of history, since I know you are now puzzled that I mentioned it. The scandal of history is when we see evil reigning within history, running riot, and God not intervening. We say, where is Christ? Where is Christ? Why does he not intervene? Does God not see what is happening? This is the scandal of history, and the scandal of monasticism is that the monk's life seems unnatural, but I will not expand on it any further. Yet the pious will rejoice beyond measure, as we shall see further on in some of the ways they show it. The pious, the steadfast, those with a deep, cruciform spirit, will glorify God for this martyric witness of God's saints. They will say, these two saints gave their witness. They were put to death for the glory of God's saints. And they will await, with much consolation and comfort in expectation, the Lord Jesus from the heavens. So you see the same event yielding different results in the various sorts of people. In the lax Christians, in the persecutors, and in the faithful. But which is this great city in which all these things will be played out? It is Jerusalem, beloved. If you ask, is it the geographical Jerusalem? Or is it perhaps some city, so-called merely in name, which is not in fact Jerusalem? For example, as we'll see it mentioned further on, when we look closely at our passages, Babylon the Great, the harlot, the one who, as it says, made the peoples of the earth drunk with the wine of her fornication. Which Babylon? To begin with, when the holy evangelist was writing the Revelation, Babylon no longer existed. Many centuries earlier, Babylon had been destroyed. It did not exist. The holy author certainly knew that Babylon was no longer there, so the name carries a figurative meaning. He means Rome, which, he says, became drunk, on the blood of the saints. And it is nothing other than the persecutions of Rome that were being unleashed at that time against the Christians. But all the powers set against God also fall under the name Babylon. So perhaps it is not Jerusalem after all. Yet, it does appear that it is Jerusalem. And this is shown by a whole host of telling cases. First of all, St. Andrew of Caesarea. This is why I read out the opinions of the fathers. And I know the opinions of the fathers are tiring, but I read them for the sake of grounding, so that no one can say I am interpreting on my own. God forbid, I interpret nothing on my own. So St. Andrew of Caesarea writes, and their bodies will lie unburied in this Jerusalem. That is, in the old and ruined Jerusalem, the one in which the Lord also suffered. He even adds an explanation, namely, in this old city, the ruined one, the one torn down by the Romans. Or rather, in this city where the Lord suffered, in this same city, as it stands, the one which, according to the saying of David, where the Son Christ, our true God, was born according to the flesh, and so that he might make people believe that he himself is the Christ, the Antichrist, pretending to fulfill the prophetic saying which declares, I will raise up the fallen tabernacle of David, I will raise up the fallen tabernacle of David, that is, the city, and I will rebuild its ruins. And the Jews, being deceived, take this to refer to his coming. The Antichrist will establish himself in Jerusalem, because he will say to the Jews, I have come to fulfill the prophecy to raise up the fallen tabernacle of David, and therefore I am the Messiah. How will he prove this? Where will the Antichrist be? In New York, or in Melbourne, in Jerusalem? So we see that this concerns the old city, this specific geographical city. It is not a figurative name. It is the city of Jerusalem. And the following points also confirm this. First, the whole setting of the vision, with the measuring of the temple, which you remember from our previous topic, is the city in which the Antichrist is now installing himself. Second, the description of the city as Sodom and Egypt is significant. My dear friends, the fact that it is a specific city matters, because when we come to see these things, and we have not yet seen them, but we will. When we see, for example, should the temple be built that the Antichrist will build, as Saint Cyril of Jerusalem says, which temple? The other city will not be built. It will be built right there. When we see these things happen, they will help us to discern them as signs of the times. These things carry great weight. So the second point is this, that this great city is called Sodom and Egypt. First of all, why is it called a great city? Because of the great renown of the city. Not that it is great in size. Jerusalem is not a large city, but it has great renown. Just like Athens. Athens at this moment may have 3 million people in the basin of Attica. Let us say that at this moment it is a great city. It is not a great city because of its population. It is a great city because of its renown. Athens, ancient Athens. And here, Jerusalem, the city of wisdom, the city out of which Christianity came forth, the city from which the Lord of heaven and earth came. So it is great in the sense of being renowned. But why is Jerusalem described as Sodom and Egypt? My dear friends, the prophets describe the city of Jerusalem in just this way. For example, Jeremiah 23:14 says, "And they all became who? The people of Jerusalem, like Sodom. And those who dwell in her, in whom? In Jerusalem, like Gomorrah." So the prophets describe the city as Sodom and Gomorrah. And when the holy evangelist here describes Jerusalem as Sodom, and indeed says spiritually, that is, allegorically, he means Jerusalem itself, and not some allegory. There is the explicit observation of the holy author that the two prophets will be killed in the city where their Lord was also crucified. And it is well known that the Lord was crucified in Jerusalem. All these things show, my dear friends, that the city is Jerusalem. But here are a few useful thoughts on these observations. The city will be Jerusalem, because in this city, according to the entirely correct observation of Saint Andrew of Caesarea, which I read to you a moment ago, the Antichrist will seek to install himself, as I told you, in order to prove that he is the awaited Messiah. The spiritual condition of the city at that time will be like Sodom and like Egypt. Why? Like Sodom. Because, quite simply, there will be much sin there. Very much sin. Why like Egypt, figuratively? Because Egypt had tormented the Israelites back then. When they had remained 430 years in Egypt, they tormented them greatly. They set them to make bricks, to build, to heavy labor, in order to wear them down, because they were afraid of them. They drowned the baby boys in the river Nile and did many other things. Just as Israel suffered under the Egyptians, so the new Israel, the church, will suffer under the old Israel, Jerusalem. This is why it is described as Egypt. Do you want proof? Zionism, this Jewish contrivance, which is spread over the whole earth and has set its sights on the Christians, secretly today and openly tomorrow. Zionism will turn against the church. That is why it is called Egypt. The protocols of the elders of Zion, if you read them, are worth reading. At first glance, they seem like a fairy tale. At first glance, someone might say, "Oh, that isn't from there. What is all this?" But we see, my beloved, that these things are being carried out. So the protocols of the elders of Zion, a little booklet, it is sold out there. Find it, read it. It is nothing but a long catalog of the effort to corrupt the nations, to destroy and to corrupt the peoples. When television puts on what it puts on, when there exist the things that exist in entertainment, in politics, in the economy, everywhere, in education, read it and you will be amazed. You will say, "But why would they destroy the nations? Why strike them like an octopus against the rock to soften it? Why paralyze the nations?" And then the Antichrist will come and say, "I will save you now. I will save you." For by then, the nations will no longer be able to react to anything. On the contrary, they will be asking for a single ruler to govern over all the earth, because their corruption will have reached its very limit. And the Zionists will have labored toward exactly this. That is why it is called Let me say it one more time: Jerusalem, Sodom, and Egypt, to corrupt the world and to dominate the world. Sodom to corrupt, Egypt to dominate. If one pays a little attention, he will see the letter of the text crying out the reality to him. And people from every tribe and tongue and nation look upon their dead bodies for 3.5 days, and they do not allow their dead bodies to be laid in a tomb. That is, from among the peoples, the tribes, the tongues, and the nations, they see the corpse of the two prophets for 3.5 days, and the rulers of the city, the Antichrist, do not permit them to be buried in a tomb. This expression, peoples, tribes, tongues, and nations, one he uses many times, shows how universal this whole matter is. That is to say, the matter is not local, in connection with what I told you in the first homily, in the Aporia, the Apocalypse, my beloved, is a universal book. It is not a Greek one, and they look, and they see. From the tribes, the peoples, the tongues, and the nations. That is, they see it worldwide. How do they see it? Unthinkable once, now thinkable. You understand it yourselves, by means of television. These phrases some years back were the unthinkable. These phrases were unthinkable, and one might interpret them in the ordinary way. But you see, according to the sound observation of Andrew of Caesarea, everything that comes to pass will be understood. The point is this: how will the peoples and the nations and the tongues see it? That is, how is it possible to listen? They will not read it in a newspaper. They will see it. For 3.5 days, they will see the corpses of the prophets in the square of Jerusalem. They will see it with their own eyes. Well, how do they see it? From where? Each one is very far from Jerusalem. How? By television. It is astonishing. But still, here he also expresses the feelings of the world, for everyone will be watching. If, for example, my beloved, there is a football match, and it is very interesting, extremely interesting. Now tell me, wouldn't they head straight to their televisions right on schedule to watch? Of course they would. This very thing, that everyone will be glued to their televisions watching the event. This expresses the feelings of the people who go looking for the spectacle of the murder of the prophets, and also for the display of their corpses in the city of Jerusalem. This display of the unburied corpses will last 3.5 days, just as correspondingly the witness of the two prophets lasted 3.5 years. 3.5 years. 3.5 years their witness. 3.5 days the display of their corpses in the city of Jerusalem. And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them, and make merry, and shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwelt on the earth. Oh, look at the dwellers. Oh, the depth of wickedness. All the inhabitants of the earth, by means of television, as I told you, will see, and will rejoice, and will make merry. And why? Do you think? Because they were rid of the tormenting preaching of the two prophets. So the preaching torments the consciences, the convicting preaching torments the consciences. One observation we could make here. An atheist has no reason to be convicted. An unbeliever, why should he be convicted? Since the unbeliever and the atheist are not convicted, then why should they be tormented? Since he does not believe in hell, my beloved atheists are not tormented. Yet they are the ones who unleash the persecution against the Christians. Why? Because, quite simply, there is no absolute atheist. There is no absolute atheist. Man is made to believe. God made us for himself. It is a drawing of the antitype of the image of God, of the antitype toward the prototype. This cannot be uprooted. It is within our very making, within this fabric of ours. Thus, the one who proclaims that he is an atheist, in reality, in his subconscious, retains a fear. And when he sees that he is threatened by this fear, he wants to and does carry out the persecutions, precisely, in order to be rid of the fear. This is the psychology of the atheist man. So it is a very telling observation that the inhabitants of the earth will exchange gifts. They will exchange gifts with one another. Thank you. Thank you all. But this custom had already been established among the Jews from the time of the Babylonian captivity. And we find it in the book of Esther. There Mordecai established this feast. And among the other observances of the feast, there was also this, the exchange of portions of food, or of gifts. So here we see that their joy is so great that now the inhabitants of the earth exchange gifts among themselves. At last they have been freed from that convicting preaching of the two prophets, and now they have nothing left to fear. They can sleep soundly. And while all of this will seem to show that evil has triumphed once and for all, immediately afterward, the first crack in that triumph begins to appear. And after the 3.5 days, a spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon those who beheld them. After the 3.5 days, a spirit of life came from God, and the two prophets stood up on their feet, and great fear fell upon all those who were watching them. This, my dear ones, is the true triumph that follows the Antichrist's apparent victory. It is the triumph of heaven. It is the resurrection of the two prophets. The great error of the atheists and the unbelievers is twofold. First of all, they deny the eschatological dimension of history. He never imagines, he does not believe, that history will come to an end. This is something I have only gradually come to understand. I share with you my own experiences as well. Many things remain unintelligible in the mind of a believer. He wonders, but how can this be? And little by little he begins to understand. So I begin to gain the experience that the atheist gives no eschatological dimension to history. For the atheist, history will simply roll on and exist forever. There is no end of the world, no end of creation. This is the atheist's first error. And the second error concerns the reality of the resurrection of the dead. If you tell me they do not believe in the second one, well, they do not believe in the first either. But these are their two enormous errors. In any case, all the efforts of the atheists move with the aim of erasing these two truths. For them, the resurrection, when it happens, will be the greatest shock of all. That is why they will be astounded when, there on the television, my dear ones, they will see the two prophets rising from the dead. For there they will be watching them on the television, dead and thrown out. And then suddenly, because God will have so arranged it that their eyes are glued to the television to see it, there suddenly they will see the two prophets, whom they believed would have already begun to rot, standing upright on their feet. Terrifying, the greatest shock an atheist could ever undergo. And after the 3.5 days, let us pause on this point. St. Andrew of Caesarea writes, "He numbers the days of the standing of their prophecy. Those who died together will rise again together." 3.5 days he counts them, corresponding to the 3.5 years during which they had preached, and after they were put to death, they will rise again. These 3.5 days that the prophets remain dead are roughly a type of the resurrection of Christ. A spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet. The whole phrasing reminds us of the well-known vision of the prophet Ezekiel. It is what we hear on Great Friday evening, which is at the matins of Great Saturday, the prophecy. He says to him, "Prophecy," and as he was commanded, and it entered into them, the bones, scattered across the plain, heard, and the Spirit entered into them, and they lived and stood upon their feet. Now notice, here is an interpretive observation to help you, my dear ones, to understand Holy Scripture as far as that is possible. The prophecies, as I was telling you last time, the prophecies of the prophets of the Old Testament have not been exhausted. The fact that the phrasing of the holy evangelist is taken from Ezekiel is as if he were telling us, "My key, O reader, I keep in my pocket, only take care to find it." There Ezekiel said the following, "Did you see, O man, did you see how these stripped, bare bones stood and rose up? Upright men, ready, with sinews, with flesh, with bones, and so on. Did you see? In the same way I will bring you up out of your graves and lead you into the land of the promise." And how do the Jews interpret this? The Jews interpret it allegorically and say, it is the return of the Jews, which will be a kind of resurrection, when they go back to their homeland, Palestine. My dear ones, God uses history, certainly, to serve certain historical points, but God never remains within history. The prophecies have a typological character. Let me repeat it, take care, they have a typological character. They go beyond history. Which history? The particular history, the particular events. They transcend it and reach to the last things. For God cared little about the case of the Jews returning to Palestine. It interested him only as a small prophecy. As what? That since the return from the captivity of the Jews to Palestine was accomplished, then all the more surely will the resurrection of the dead from their graves also be fulfilled. That is why Christ said, "Do not be amazed, do not marvel, that the hour is coming when the dead in their tombs will hear the voice of the Son of Man. And those in the graves, those who are in the tombs, will rise and be raised up." So that vision of Ezekiel historically refers to Israel. But in reality, at its depth, against the background of the great prophecy, it refers to the resurrection of the dead. Most rightly, then, our church placed it among the prophecies to be read at the matins of Great Saturday. And the key is here, the very same phrasing that the holy evangelist takes from there. "Tell me, please, do these things bring you comfort?" This is the comfort of the faithful, the resurrection of the dead, the resurrection of the dead. Does it comfort you? I tell you sincerely, if these things leave you without a single tremor within you, then I would tell you not to bother sitting and listening to anything anymore. Do not bother. Their whole purpose is that within us should be born this astonishment and this comfort, this sense that we have before us the resurrection of the dead. Nevertheless, the fact that the two prophets were raised is the answer to this foolish struggle of the Antichrist against the two prophets. Here the faithful of that time could say, "Truly Christ is the life and the resurrection. Christ is true." But all of this, the fact that the two prophets will be raised, will form a wondrous, living, vivid picture before believers and unbelievers alike. For the believers, too, will be watching on television. And the unbelievers, too, will be watching on television. And it will be the resurrection of the dead, which a little while later will happen to all people. All those who have died, or who have been dead from ages past, will be raised. And these words of the holy evangelist are very realistic. He says, "And they stood upon their feet, they stood up on their own 2 feet." We know the allegorical interpretation. Let me speak in the language of Basil the Great in his Hexameron. We know the allegorical interpretation, but this passage does not admit an allegorical reading. "For when, my beloved," the Old Testament writes, "as I have told you before, and indeed recently, that where the feet of God, of the Lord, stood, where they stood, the feet stood, which feet?" Yes, it presupposes the incarnation. Realism, realism, the place where the feet of God stood. And here too it says, "the prophets stood upon their feet." This is what the resurrection means. This is what the resurrection means. I stand on my own feet. For this very reason, there is also a canon that on Sunday we do not kneel and do not make prostrations, in order to express the resurrection of the dead in a realistic and not an allegorical way. And great fear fell upon those who beheld them. Fear and terror fell upon those who were watching them. Upon those who beheld, you see it constantly. Those who behold, the ones who are watching, always the television in front of them. The television is working now. The television is working. And then great fear will fall upon them. Of course, my beloved, a person is afraid of whatever natural thing can frighten him. If at this moment a window shatters, an explosion happens, of course he will be frightened at once. He will be frightened. But a person can overcome natural fears. What he cannot overcome is supernatural fear. This supernatural fear literally paralyzes a person. A small example. You go to a funeral. The relatives follow. The friends. All the neighbors. And so on. A great crowd. The coffin in front. And we go toward the cemetery. There at the cemetery, we gather around the grave for the burial to take place. Well, we lift the lid for one last kiss, something like that. And there suddenly, we see the dead man rise up to his feet. Tell me, I beg you, what will the people do? To put it in plain Greek, they scatter every which way. Why, what were they afraid of? Follow me, what were they afraid of? They were afraid of the dead man. But they should have rejoiced. The dead man has been raised. What were they afraid of? Ah, they were not afraid of the dead man. They were afraid of their contact with the supernatural element. That is what terrifies. The supernatural element terrifies. My beloved, a thief may break into your house. A robber. And you can overcome the fear. Take up your gun, your knife. I don't know what. But when the devil appears in your room, what will you do? You will fall down stiff. That is supernatural fear. Fear fell upon the whole earth when they saw the two prophets standing on their feet. A loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." And they ascended into heaven in the cloud, and their enemies beheld them. I heard a voice saying from heaven, "It is the voice of Christ, calling the two witnesses and saying to them, come up here, into heaven. This come up here, is the resolution of the great drama of the earth. Never could the unbelievers, as I told you earlier, the unbelievers could never conceive of heaven as the resolution of the drama of the earth. Just as Minos, the king of Crete, could never have conceived that his prisoner Daedalus and his son Icarus would escape from the labyrinth with wings. It is the vertical dimension that saves, since the horizontal dimension is incapable of redeeming man. It is heaven. And how was the ascent of the two prophets accomplished? As Andrew of Caesarea says, by the lordly vehicle, the cloud, with the lordly vehicle, the cloud. Just as a ruler might send his vehicle to the airport to receive and collect a distinguished visitor. Indeed, my beloved, the cloud is the lordly vehicle that is sent to collect the two prophets. Here the ascension of Christ is brought to mind, as the Acts of the Apostles recalls in the first chapter, verse 9. A cloud received him. A cloud took him up, and he went into heaven. But this cloud is not a cloud made of droplets, like a cloud familiar to us. It is a cloud of glory. It also brings to mind what the Apostle Paul says in the first epistle to the Thessalonians. Chapter 4, verse 16. And the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we who are alive, who remain, who will have been left behind, shall be caught up together with them in the clouds. Together with those who will have been raised, we shall be caught up in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, to go and meet the Lord. And so we shall always be with the Lord, and thus we shall always be together with the Lord. There are Christians who today have no faith, just as Christians have no faith in the resurrection of the dead, since they have no faith in the resurrection of Christ. One will say to you, Christ is risen. He has his red eggs. He goes to the resurrection service. He holds his candle. And yet he does not believe in the resurrection of Christ, a terrible thing. And not only that, as I said, he also does not believe in the consequences of the resurrection of Christ, which is the resurrection of the dead. The Apostle Paul says, if the dead are not raised, then neither has Christ been raised. Then our faith is in vain, and our preaching is in vain as well. What are we doing? And what is Christianity, if there is no resurrection of the dead? So many lukewarm believers, lukewarm Christians, faithless ones, who do not believe in the resurrection and the ascension of Christ, and by extension in the resurrection and ascension of the dead, will be given one last testimony when they see the resurrection of the two prophets. But what will these people do then? Perhaps they will believe, as the next verse, which we will see further on, also shows. Nevertheless, it strikes us, the repeated noting of the phrase about the enemies of the two prophets, what it is. And their enemies beheld them, and their enemies saw them. This word beheld. They were beholding. They were watching continually. As I explained to you, I will say it one more time, and for the last time, all of this will be seen worldwide on television. And in that hour there was a great earthquake, and a tenth of the city fell, and in the earthquake 7,000 persons were killed, and the rest were afraid and gave glory to the God of heaven. At the time when the two prophets are raised and ascend into heaven, an earthquake will take place on the earth. This earthquake will be, it seems, only in the city of Jerusalem, on this Andrew of Caesarea writes. Perhaps these things will then also be felt. Perhaps it will be a real, actual earthquake, not something powerful only in a figurative sense. In any case, my beloved, I see something astonishing here. Pay attention. And you will see how far we may take certain things, whether literally or allegorically. The two prophets died, they were raised, and an earthquake takes place. When Christ gave up his spirit, at the closed hour of midday upon the cross, a great earthquake took place. And when he rose again, a great earthquake took place, only it was local, and this earthquake came from the presence of the angel. It was not an ordinary earthquake, it was the angel who came down and rolled away the stone. And the earthquake happened so that the soldiers would be terrified and turn as yellow as a gold coin. As we said, it is contact with the metaphysical, the supernatural reality. And so the soldiers took to their heels and announced the resurrection of Christ. So an earthquake took place both with the death and with the resurrection of Christ. And now an earthquake takes place with the resurrection of the two prophets. This is why it is probably going to be a literal, perceptible earthquake. With this difference, however, that in the case of the city of Jerusalem then, in the days of the two prophets, 1/10 of the city will fall from the tremors. It will be torn down. Whereas in the time of Christ, nothing was torn down, and 7,000 people will be killed. Now, the 1/10 and the 7,000 Tevin, if these are not literal but symbolic, that perhaps. But at the same time, this earthquake is two things. First, that it will be a confirmation from heaven that the prophets were from God, that the Antichrist is false. And second, with the earthquake comes the punishment of those who had not believed. The rest, what they will do is this, they will be afraid and will glorify God. But it is a forced glorification, like the centurion then, at the time of the crucifixion of Christ, who, seeing the things that took place at the crucifixion, glorified God. Now the centurion is another matter. Deep down he had a good disposition and became a martyr fritzin, a Christian and a martyr, the centurion. But here, my beloved, the people will then glorify God by compulsion, not out of repentance. We see fear driving people, and the text continues and closes our chapter, not the whole chapter, but the paragraph. The second woe is past, behold, the third woe comes quickly. Of course, the time we have for this analysis is brief, so perhaps you will not recall that when the fifth, sixth, and seventh angels sounded their trumpets, these were marked not merely as trumpet blasts and plagues, but also as three woes at the fifth angel, the first woe, at the sixth angel, the second woe, and at the seventh angel, the third woe. The first woe has passed, and because the analysis lingered so long on the second woe, since at the same time there intervened not only the locusts of the abyss, but also the two interludes. Now, my beloved, the second woe comes to an end, and what remains belongs to the third. To the third, alas, that will come with the sounding of the seventh angel. With this difference, however, that although we are now in the 11th chapter, the plague itself essentially begins from the 13th chapter. In between, come weighty themes that form the very center of the book of Revelation. Let no one be absent. In between come, the woman with the child, whom the dragon pursues from behind, the battle of the archangel Michael with the dragon in heaven, the heavenly echo of the triumph in heaven, the persecution of the woman by the dragon after her child, is taken up to heaven, and she flees into the wilderness, and the appearance of the beast that comes up out of the sea in the 13th chapter, who is the Antichrist. So we find ourselves, my beloved, as you can see, at the core, at the central part now of the book of Revelation. But, God first, we will continue this coming Sunday.